The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello and welcome to this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman with the Virginia Voice. We continue with our article from last week from SmithsonianMag.com. Ayako, Cuba in a Cauldron, October 14, 2016. Most famously, the preeminent anthropologist Fernando Ortiz compared all of Cuba to an ayako. This is Cuba, the island, the pot placed in the fire of the tropics. An unusual pot, this land of ours, just like the pot of our ayako, which must be made of clay and quite open, wrote Ortiz in a lecture delivered at the University of Havana in 1939 and published in 1940. And therein go substances of the most diverse types and origins, along with the flush of the tropics to heat it, the water of its skies to compose its broth, and the water of its seas for the sprinklings of the salt shaker. Out of all of this, our national ayako has been made. Not only did he celebrate the confluence of Taino, Spanish, and African cultures in the making of ayako, he also cited other surprising influences, including Eastern spices introduced by Chinese laborers and mild peppers brought by immigrants fleeing revolutionary Haiti. He even pointed to Anglo-American ingenuity, although with ambivalence, for simplifying domestic life and producing the metal cookware that replaced traditional clay pots used for making the stew. It wasn't the final savory result that made Ortiz see Cuba in the cauldron, but the process of cooking. Varied cuts of meat disintegrating after a long simmer, and vegetables and fruits added at certain intervals to create new textures. A constant cooking that was always evolving, creating something new. It's harder to know what Ortiz would have thought of this quintessentially Cuban dish establishing itself on the other side of the Florida Straits. But for many Cubans in the diaspora, the longing to connect to their country is fulfilled at the stove. The ritual of finding the right ingredients, the roots that are at the base of the stew, the special cuts of beef or pork, the plantains in various stages of ripening, are ways to experience the island from afar. Ayako has a place in my life too. My grandfather's yearning for the dish awakened my curiosity. I now take comfort in the flavors, learning something new with each attempt at the recipe, and never taking a single spoonful for granted. That was Ayako, Cuba in a Cauldron by Ana Sofias Peleas. Our next article is from mychinaroots.com. The Chinese community in Cuba. Chinese people had been migrating to Cuba since the 19th century, when thousands of workers were brought to the Caribbean country as contract laborers. Havana's Chinatown is one of the oldest Chinatowns in Latin America, and the rich history of Chinese Cubans has resulted in distinct cultural outputs, such as Chinese-Cuban cuisine, in various countries and regions. Early history. Chinese immigration to Cuba started in 1837, when Chinese, Cantonese, and Hakka contract workers were brought to work in the sugar fields. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese workers were brought in from mainland China, Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan during the following decades to replace and or work alongside African and mixed blood-free slaves. After completing 8-year contracts or otherwise obtaining their freedom, while most of the Chinese workers wished to be repatriated to their homeland, some Chinese immigrants settled permanently in Cuba. Some 105,000 immigrants from the U.S. came to Cuba during the late 19th century to escape anti-Asian discrimination, which was rife at the time. Another, albeit smaller, wave of Chinese immigration also arrived in the 20th century, some as supporters of the communist cause during the Cuban Revolution, and others as dissidents escaping the Chinese authorities. The original Chinese coolie populations to arrive in Cuba were almost entirely male, resulting in a large number of intermarriages and mixed-race offspring. 20th century. When the new revolutionary government led by Fidel Castro came to power in 1959, the economic and political situation changed. Many Chinese grocery store owners, having had their properties expropriated by the new government, left Cuba. Most of them settled in the U.S., particularly near Florida, whilst relatively few others fled to the Dominican Republic, other Latin American countries, and the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. As a result of this exodus, the number of pure Chinese dropped sharply in Havana's Barrio Chino, Chinatown. Modern history. The Barrio Chino de la Habana, Chinatown, Havana, is no longer among the largest Chinatowns in Latin America, with most Chinese Cubans living outside this area. Several community groups, especially the Chinatown Promotional Group, have worked in recent decades to revive Barrio Chino and the faded Chinese culture. The Chinese Language and Art School opened in 1993 and has grown since then, helping Chinese Cubans to strengthen their knowledge of the Chinese language. Today, Chinese Cubans tend to speak Mandarin, Cantonese, Hakka, and a mixture of Chinese and Spanish, in addition to Spanish and English. They also promoted small businesses like beauty parlors, mechanical shops, restaurants, and small groceries, provided to them to create a view of Barrio Chino. This has helped to give visibility to the Chinese-Cuban community in more recent years. Estimated population, 114,240. That was the Chinese community in Cuba. Our next article is from revisitapanorama.com, Traces of China in Panama, by Anna Teresa Benjamin. Chinese influence can be seen in mafa, a fried bread that changed from sweet to savory over time, or the fiao, a system of purchases on credit that continues to prevail in small neighborhood shops. Chinese influences can be seen in the red color of business entrances, the lucky cat figurines, the acupuncture clinics, the educational system, and newspapers in Chinese. Chinese people first came to Panama around 1852, when the furor accompanying construction of the Trans-Isthmian Railroad was at its height. In her book, How, When, and Why the Chinese Came to Panama, Berta Alicia Chen explains that the first group of 300 sailed to the isthmus in 1852 from a British-ruled port. The most famous ship carrying Chinese to Panama was arguably the brigantine Sea Witch in 1854. A group of 712 men spent several weeks crammed in the belly of that ship in unsanitary conditions without sufficient food. They reached Tobago on Friday, March 30th. Only 701 set foot on land. The men were placed in camps along the railroad under construction. 32 fell ill and died soon after landing. The following week, another 80 suffered the effects of dysentery, malaria, yellow fever, or malnutrition, notes Chen. The survivors did not fare that well either. Even though the Chinese were good workers, the other laborers harassed them for their different appearance and customs. But the worst blow was the railroad company's decision, for economic reasons, to stop providing opium, which supposedly kept the Chinese laborers on an even emotional keel. Deprived of the drug that had helped them bear the difficult working conditions and climate and prey to loneliness, confused by language and cultural differences, lacking sufficient food, oppressed, the Chinese grew melancholy and began to commit suicide. Most of the suicides took place in the town of Matiching. Some hung themselves by their pigtails. Others stabbed themselves with metal rods or fell upon machetes. A few hung stones around their necks and dived into the water, while yet others starved themselves to death. The early history of the Chinese in Panama was as wretched as in other countries in the Americas, where they arrived in conditions approximating slavery. As Antonio Wong writes in the anthology Scions of the Dragon, 26 Chinese Panamanian poets, published a few months ago. Those promises and decisions they suffered, the malaria and jungle fever, and the terrible invasions of armies of mosquitoes, inhospitable conditions that drove many to suicide. Over time, the Chinese moved away from hard labor, first on the railroad and then on construction of the canal, and created gardens, businesses, and temples. A Chinatown grew up near Sauce Puedes and soon became indispensable to the rest of society for its culinary options, laundries, bakeries, hardware stores, and wholesale and retail stores offering every product under the sun. As Dagoberto Chung, an all-around man of the theater and Cologne storyteller, says about his father in the same anthology, "Child sprout growing among the rice furrows, young traveler, adventurous traveler, seed of the diaspora crossing the sea. Here he was an alien, a bricklayer, a cook, an artisan, a stevedore, a worker, a shopkeeper. Today, the Chinese are integrated into this diverse country, and sometimes subtly and sometimes palpably, they continue to impress lucidity, knowledge, and life upon a society that does not always grasp how much it owes them." Chinatowns. Up to the beginning of the 20th century, the Chinese in Panama City lived in shacks, but they gradually populated houses in crowded neighborhoods, such as Avenida B and what is now the capital's historic center. Here they organized temples, societies, and gaming halls, which allowed them to conserve their customs and traditions in a strange land. This turn-of-the-century neighborhood still survives, with its diversity of shops and restaurants, redolence of incense and dragons and fireworks in the main street during New Year festivities. Avenida B, for example, is home to popular shops selling trinkets and supplies for children's parties, as well as restaurants where chicken and roast pork hang in the windows, clearly wooing passerbys to step in and sample the wares. The increasing Chinese population outgrew the traditional Chinatown, and some years ago, new businesses run by Chinese families began to expand to the El Dorado area of the city. As in the old neighborhood, the area abounds in shops selling groceries and other items, but there are also a noticeable number of barbershops and clothing stores. This district is in fact home to the China-Panama Cultural Center, or Sun Yat-sen Institute, finished in 1992, which offers Mandarin language, music, painting, cooking, and martial arts classes, among others. The school includes the country's only library specializing in Sinology. Friendship Park. This is perhaps one of the most peaceful places in a city that can be chaotic despite its small size. Located across from the Sun Yat-sen Institute, the China-Panama Friendship Park is an oasis of tranquility that welcomes visitors with a good luck fountain and invites them to stroll the three bridges representing luck, long life, and happiness. A brisk walk of no more than 10 minutes will take you around the park, but it is meant to be enjoyed at a slower pace, one that allows you to admire the falling leaves and the shades of water in the turtle pond. The pond is known as a lake of happiness, and in the center stands a sculpture of the Virgin of Mercy as a symbol of the friendship between two kindred nations. A few contemplative moments on the terrace do not go amiss after the stroll. The stillness and the wind energize your spirit, and a half hour in the park gives you the strength to once again face this city's insane traffic. From temples to restaurants, a must-see is the Buddhist temple, located on the Trans-Isthmian Highway near the Colegio La Salle. The unusual decoration alone is a delight for people of a different religious persuasion. Lung Fung and Golden Unicorn are considered two of the best restaurants, but daring diners might wish to venture to some of the restaurants at the rear of the El Dorado Shopping Center on the avenue dubbed Silent Tomb. If you are looking for Chinese ornaments or symbols, across from Lung Fung stands an anonymous shop. Ask the locals for directions. Featuring a selection of cultural figures and symbols, the dragon, the monkey, Buddha, etc. But dishware, vases, clothing, foods, and pots of different sizes and shapes for growing bonsai are also available. If you happen to be in Panama City on February 8th, stop by Chinatown, very near the seafood market on the coastal beltway, and help usher in the year of the monkey. The poetry of descendants. March of 2015 saw the presentation of the book Skins of the Dragon, 26 Chinese Panamanian Poets, which showcases some of the poetry written by Panamanians of Chinese descent, including Carlos Francisco Cheng Marin, Antonio Wong, Cesar Young Nunez, Gloria Young, Carlos Fong, and Lucy Christina Chow. The book includes notable texts by deceased artist, educator, and political leader Cheng Marin on the canal, life in the countryside, and Isthmus heroes such as Victoriano Lorenzo. There is also the pessimism of Arnaldo Diaz Wong, whose poem, Time Leaves Us Fragments of Worry, offers us this verse. We live to occupy the womb of death. Carlos Fong addresses more current topics in his poem, We Were Not Heroes, about the 2011 death of five young men in a Panamanian jail. We were not heroes. We were only children of violence and fear. We consumed hatred we had already tasted. Our rage was deflected back in dedications. The debt we owed, we paid with ashes and a vestige of skin. Gloria Young reveals her raw eroticism, and Lucy Christina Chow deals with love and humor. Compiled by Louis Wong Vega, this book is a continuation of the 2012 volume, An Anthology of Cologne Poetry. Chinese New Year in Panama. The Fayan Society, in conjunction with the Panama City Mayor's Office, celebrates the Chinese New Year in style at the Figali Convention Center on Calzada de Amador. The festivity features dances, performances, and a banquet of culinary delights from this age-old culture. That was Traces of China in Panama. Our next article is from Orietai.com. Celebrating the Chinese New Year, a cultural tapestry across Latin America. January 19th, 2026. As the sun sets on a bustling street in Panama's Chinatown, red lanterns sway gently in the evening breeze, casting a warm glow over families gathered to celebrate the Chinese New Year. The air is thick with anticipation, and the fragrant aroma of traditional dishes wafts from nearby stalls. This vibrant scene is not just a local celebration. It reflects centuries of history and cultural exchange that have shaped communities across Latin America. The roots of this festival stretch back to the 1850s, when Chinese immigrants first arrived in Panama, contributing significantly to major projects like railroads and canals, while also bringing their rich traditions along with them. The Yanuo Religious Society Temple stands as a testament to this heritage, built in 1898 as a sanctuary for those far from home during festive times like these. In Cuba's Havana, echoes of Cantonese opera fill the air as performers don elaborate costumes reminiscent of an era long past. These performances are more than mere entertainment. They serve as vital links connecting generations through shared stories and customs. Such celebrations bring joy and color into lives that might otherwise feel disconnected from their ancestral roots. Across borders in Brazil's Sao Paulo, preparations for upcoming festivities are already underway. Dancers rehearse intricate routines, while musicians tune their instruments for what promises to be an unforgettable gala event welcoming 2025. Yang Yu Young from Brazil's China Association observes how interest has surged among locals eager to learn about Chinese culture and strengthening ties between nations. Argentina joins this growing chorus too. Buenos Aires streets come alive with dragon dances, accompanied by rhythmic drumming, a symbol of good fortune for all who participate. Germain Bermudez teaches these ancient arts at Longchong School, where students immerse themselves year-round, preparing for moments like these that honor both tradition and community spirit. What makes these celebrations so special? It lies not only within fireworks lighting up night skies or delicious feasts, but also with heartfelt connections forged through shared experiences across diverse cultures. A beautiful reminder that even oceans apart can unite us under one sky filled with hope. That was Celebrating the Chinese New Year, a cultural tapestry across Latin America. Our next article is from the same website, A Tale of Two New Years, Chinese and American Celebrations. As the clock strikes midnight on December 31st, Americans erupt in cheers, fireworks light up the sky, and resolutions are made with hopeful hearts. This is a time for new beginnings, celebrated with parties that often last until dawn. In contrast, just weeks later, another celebration unfolds across the globe, the Chinese New Year, marked by vibrant parades filled with dragon dances and family reunions steeped in tradition. The differences between these two celebrations reflect not only cultural practices, but also historical context. The American New Year centers around individual aspirations. It's about personal growth and setting goals for self-improvement. People gather at homes or public spaces to celebrate togetherness while embracing their hopes for the year ahead. On the other hand, Chinese New Year emphasizes familial bonds and ancestral respect. It's a time when families come together from far-flung places to honor their heritage through rituals, such as cleaning their homes to sweep away bad luck, or preparing traditional dishes like dumplings symbolizing wealth. The festival lasts several days, often up to 15, and each day has its own significance, ranging from honoring deities to visiting friends. Language plays an interesting role in how these celebrations are perceived globally. While many Western leaders wish people a happy Lunar New Year, this term can spark debate among communities who feel it dilutes cultural identity by omitting Chinese. For instance, Vietnamese people refer to their celebrations as Tet Nguyen Dan, while Koreans call it Skolal. Both share similar customs rooted deeply in Confucian values, yet prefer distinct identities separate from China. In America today, there's an increasing awareness of diverse cultures, leading some businesses and politicians towards more inclusive greetings during this festive season, an effort sometimes seen as politically correct, but also met with skepticism regarding authenticity versus appropriation. Interestingly enough, despite geographical distances or differing traditions surrounding food, think sweet rice cakes versus champagne, both holidays converge on one fundamental theme: hope for prosperity and happiness in the coming year, a universal desire transcending borders. That was A Tale of Two New Years, Chinese and American Celebrations. Ancient poems to welcome in Chinese New Year. What will the new year bring? 854. The road to Ba is a long, long way. Still, I make this perilous journey of 10,000 li in the melting snow, beneath jagged mountains at night, a stranger in a strange land. Alone, gradually growing distant from family and friends, and closer instead to my companions. How does one bear moving from place to place? What will the new year bring? New Year's Eve snow, 11:25. At midnight, the north wind brought a heavy snow, the snow that was given to us by the gods just arrived on New Year's Eve, which showed the harvest of the coming year. Hold the glass of the half-baked Tusu wine. It has no time to celebrate the new year, and I should use the grass to write the peach symbol of the spring on snow. Chinese New Year, 10:21. The old year has passed in the sound of firecrackers, and the Tusu wine is enjoyed with a warm spring breeze. The rising sun shines on thousands of households, and the old peach symbols are removed and replaced with new peach symbols. Light rain in early spring, 7:68. The rain, like a sheen of oil on Heaven's Street, falls lightly, though one sees the color of grass from afar. If one looks closely, it is not really there. The most beautiful spring scene of the whole year is this very one, far better than the willows that hang everywhere over the city. That's all for this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.